across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is The Stephen Nolan Show!
So the draft programme for government is out. Does it give you the details? Should it? Does it make hard promises? Should it? What should you expect from it? So is it an exciting document? Is it a grounded document that inspires you that the right people are in charge? Or is it a document that isn't worth the paper it's written on? All discussed on Nolan This Morning. The Stephen Nolan Show! Good morning. There are so many people relying on our political leaders to deliver for them. There are so many vulnerable people trusting them that Stormont can change and affect and often save their lives in Northern Ireland. Not everybody is flush with cash. Not everybody is sitting in Northern Ireland this morning feeling safe. And when those people engage with politics, engage with the likes of the Nolan Show, they are listening for clear messaging from our political parties in Northern Ireland that there is a plan for their lives, for their vulnerabilities, that there has been deep thinking, that there are specific goals that will change their lives. This is not an abstract document when you hear news broadcasters this morning talking about a programme for government. It is this simple. A programme for government is how your government, Michelle O'Neill, Emma Little-Pengelly, Naomi Long and Mike Nesbitt, how they are going to prioritise your safety, your health, your family, your Northern Ireland. In their proposal to you today, in terms of your safety around policing, there is one line in an 88-page document. That's what they've come up with. One single line around policing. In terms of health, they have told you that it is their priority. Health is one of their 9 priorities. Elsewhere in the document, they say it will not be possible to reduce our lengthy waiting times within the funding currently available. So that's the big thinking from Stormont. We can't do it. It's our priority, but we can't affect you sitting on a waiting list. Sinn Féin's strategy, and it is the strategy of the wider executive, unless they get more money from Westminster, they have no idea what to do about waiting lists. No notion, no solutions, no revenue-raising proposals, no decision by Sinn Féin, no proposal by Sinn Féin or the DUP or the Alliance Party or the Ulster Unionist Party to say, look, this might be difficult for some of the wealthiest in our community, but we are proposing to take money off them to redistribute it to the poorer people in this country. Not one proposal in this programme for government about waiting lists. They're saying they can't do it. Now, a question for Mike Nesbitt this morning, the Health Minister. How have you and your party signed up to a document which says you can't do anything about waiting lists within the funding currently available? Now, is that our politicians being honest? Do you applaud them for being honest and open? Or have they just not got what it takes? If they're presenting in front of you today, we can't do anything about it unless the British give us more money. Couldn't you raise more money in Northern Ireland? You do have tax raising powers, right? You do, right? You do have revenue raising powers. To every police officer in this country, to every police officer in this country, you're risking your lives for us. The Stormont executive have put in one single line under safer communities. They say That includes actively seeking to achieve a sufficient number of police officers in line with NDNA commitments. No detail, no timeline, no redistribution of money, nothing. Anne Watt is from Pivotal. Good morning to you, Anne.
Good morning, Stephen.
Is this worth the paper it's written on?
Well, I think I'd just like to say a few positive things to start with, because I think you have been quite negative about this document in your introduction to it. I think it is important that any government says what its priorities are and what it is aiming to do. And we've had 7 months of this executive without a programme for government, so it is good that they've got to their 9 priorities. And I do think those will resonate with people. So people, you know, want, there's been a real pressure for more affordable childcare, for more support for special educational needs, for more social and affordable housing. So, and of course, waiting lists as well. So people will connect, I think, with this, and they will see our politicians listening to what their concerns are.
They're telling us they can't do anything about waiting lists with the funding they've got.
Yeah, I think the big challenge that our executive have got is that they've got huge problems in public services. We've got to a very dark place in lots of areas of public services, really poor performance, as people will know, you know, whether that's looking at health waiting lists or schools budgets or Loch Nae or policing. And there aren't the plans or the funding in place to put those right. And I pick up something you said in your introduction as being really important. I think our politicians here have been open and honest about what they can do. They could have published something which was very aspirational and that said, we're going to do everything to make all public services better for everyone. But actually, they haven't done that. They've said, in reality, we're very limited in what we can do. So I agree, this document is really disappointing when you look at what actually they're saying, what difference are they going to make.
But our First Minister is saying she's cracked it. Let's sort of, I don't want to misquote Michelle, so let's have a listen to what Michelle O'Neill, our First Minister, said yesterday.
We're launching a draft programme for government. It doesn't get more real than that. This is what we're here to do. We're here to be in government together, the four parties of the executive. We've set out very real and meaningful plans that we think will make a difference to people's lives. We're focused on prosperity and lifting everybody up. And I think that's what the public want to see. They want political leaders to work together. They want us to find solutions to the big problems of today. And that's what we think that we have cracked in the programme for government, insofar as it sets out our focus on those immediate priorities. But it also allows us to build for the future, which I think is important. So we're setting very firm foundations around how we can move forward.
Focus on immediate priorities, Anne. So let's step through this. That's what Michelle has said, our First Minister. And let's look at health. So they tell the public of Northern Ireland that health is one of their main priorities. And yet they say in a separate page, it will not be possible to reduce our lengthy waiting times within the funding currently available. So what do people do that are sitting on a 1 year, 2 year waiting list today? Because that's who I'm representing, asking questions this morning. Do they have any sense of hope from Stormont?
I think what we've got here is our politicians agreeing about their priorities, and they're pleased that they've got to that agreement. And I think we should give them credit for having worked that through and come up with 9 priorities between the four parties, because that's not an easy thing to do, right? So I think we do need to give them some credit for that. The problem is they've agreed their priorities, but what they don't have is the resources or the capacity to actually deliver very much on those things. So when I first read this document yesterday, a lot of it is a description of problems that we have, a description of how poor our public services are at present, and then some actions that the executive are going to do to try and make a difference, most of which are already announced. And I agree with you, Stephen, I nearly fell off my seat when I read that line about how there was not funding to reduce waiting lists. I read it 10 times thinking, have I misunderstood this?
So why have they?
How can you have it a priority of reducing health waiting times in your headline first page and then have a sentence in the depths of the document saying that we do not have sufficient funding to reduce waiting lists.
So in other words, what Stormont is currently saying in this draft proposal, the outcome of what they are saying, Anne, is that the rich in this society will continue to buy themselves off waiting lists by paying for private care. So the rich will be all right. They'll go and they'll get their fractures and their cancer scans and their treatment. They'll get all that because they can pay for it in the private sector. And there is absolutely no indication of any delivery from Stormont for the poor in this country, for the working class in this country who have families and don't have $2,000 and $3,000 in the bank to buy a scan. And Stormont has no ideas as to what to do for those people. Not one of those four political parties have anything new to offer this country in terms of healthcare. Is that what this document is saying?
Look, our politicians would never say that that is acceptable situation, what you've just described. They would never say that was acceptable. They absolutely recognise the problem and they want to make a difference. Unfortunately, right across this document, what we've got is high aspirations, but that meeting up against the harsh reality of the dire state of public services and the very limited funding that we have.
Look, I'm going to be... You're saying, and there is a school of thought, that for these political parties to even be able to agree what their priorities are, not solving them, just agree what they are, is an achievement. Is it fair to ask the question, are we that low in Northern Ireland in terms of capability that we've got to celebrate agreeing what the problems are, rather than how to solve them?
Well, look, remember, we haven't had government for 5 out of the last 7 years. We haven't had a programme for government since 2016. So I would say, yes, this is a step forward. Obviously, what we really want is government to make a difference in people's lives, to transform public services, to improve all those poor outcomes that we have at the minute. So, look, I agree with you. This is not at all satisfactory in terms of what it says will be done. But I think that's coming back to a theme that goes all the way through this document, which is the poor current state of public services and the very limited funding available. And I do think, Stephen, I do think it is good that our politicians have been honest about this. It's brutal and it's hard to read, but at least we know now what the limits to what they are going to be able to do.
So while Northern Ireland political parties have presented to all of you listening this morning, unless they get more money from Westminster, they have not one jot of an idea as to how to reduce waiting lists. Let me read out to you what their counterparts in Scotland have done in their programme for government. They have said that they will, and they've given numbers so they can be held accountable. They have said that they will free up 210,000 planned care outpatient appointments. They've said they will deliver 20,000 extra orthopaedic and general surgery procedures every year. They have said they will provide £120 million of additional funding for NHS boards to support continued improvements across a range of mental health services and treatments, including meeting the child and adolescent mental health services waiting time standard nationally. And they said they will clear backlogs by December 2025. So if you're a citizen in Scotland, that's what you get from your government in Scotland. In Northern Ireland, they can't do anything unless Westminster pump up.
Well, I think there's an important point here, Stephen. There are no targets in yesterday's document, so there's nothing anywhere that says this is how we will improve waiting lists, this is how we will measure the success of our action plan for Lochnae. this is how we will improve access to special educational needs support. There are no targets in the document. There's stuff about data and indicators, and I think that's all being worked on at the minute. But what is really missing here is exactly the kind of thing you just read out from the Scotland example. We need the executive right across the board, whether it's health or education or housing or violence against women and girls, we need them to say, this is what we are seeking to achieve. This is how things will change in terms of actual data, which represents what people experience day to day. And we haven't had that yet. I don't know whether we're going to get it. I hope we are going to get it, because if we don't get it, then we have no kind of indication of whether the executive has been successful or not at all.
Isn't that handy for them? No accountability, in other words.
Yeah, well, at the minute, there are no targets. There have to be targets, or this is... it's not a meaningless document, but it's certainly a very limited document. So they don't actually commit to what they're going to do.
They were talking about, yesterday when I heard about this in the news cycle, they were talking about targets after the consultation. So how on earth does the public consult on this? Tell them what they do. What are the public saying in this consultation? They what are they agreeing or disagreeing with?
Yeah, well, I think the consultation will be about, do you agree with the 9 priorities to start with? That will be the first question. And after that, it would be, do you agree that we've got the right actions in place? And then I guess it would be, you know, other things we should be doing. And I assume they're going to be deluged with responses to this, because my reading of it, a lot of people will be completely dissatisfied with what they see being done against the targets. You know, as I said before, there's a lot of descriptions of problems in this document and then some actions, but a lot of them have already been announced, so there's not much that's new. And as well as that, there's the things that are missing from the list of 9, some of which are really important, like poverty, for example, or wastewater infrastructure or social care are not there. So there'll be a lot of responses, and well, it'll be interesting to see what the executive do with those.
This program keeps grounding things on what, you know, the average person thinks, what the punter on the ground thinks. I'm mindful today that if you take the likes of people that are out selling, be it that they're selling, you know, be it that they're selling sweets in a sweet shop, be it that they're selling windows or they're selling whatever, they are under pressure as soon as they get up in the morning to meet a sales target. And they go home with some commission, and there's no guaranteed money for them. And that's how they have to fight to be able to pay the bills. And what Stormont has done within this document, in terms of many different key areas for Northern Ireland, the targets are just conveniently not there.
The targets may come, Stephen. I don't know. They're not there at the minute, but they may come as they do more work on the data.
So they haven't had enough time?
Possibly. Well, I mean, that's what they would say, but they have had 7 months.
Several
years before that as well, when there was no executive. So, yeah, it's really the lack of targets, the lack of commitment to actual improvements is a big shortcoming. And, you know, certainly a lot of people will be saying you must address that. They must put specific
housing
commitments in place.
Housing. So, again, for these parties that purport to represent working class communities, social housing. They tell us what they haven't been able to do. The executive, they say, has not been able to deliver on its ambition of 2,500 new social homes a year. They say we want to commit to the long-term public subsidy required to deliver more social homes while innovating to develop new funding models. So what are the new funding models? What is the innovation? Nada. They say we will deliver a Northern Ireland housing supply strategy. Any hint of what's in it? Nothing. Then they go with that bowl out again. We're seeking Treasury agreement for appropriate treatment of borrowing to enable the Northern Ireland Housing Executive to increase investment in its homes. Now, some might describe that as a begging bowl. Other people might say they're working to get the Treasury to move. But again, any targets for how many homes they're going to build in Northern Ireland? Any assurance to people that are sitting on a social housing waiting list? Why is it not in there, Anne?
I don't know, Stephen. I mean, it genuinely may be because they haven't had enough time to work out what the target should be. You know, if you commit to a target, you've got to be sure you're going to be able to achieve it. So they need to be careful about that. So there'll be quite a lot of work involved in it. Or if you're going to be more, more sceptical, you might say they know the targets aren't going to be very impressive. And so they're unwilling to be black and white about them. But, you know, in my view, it's there need to be targets. I mean, I think, Stephen, you're being very negative about this whole thing this morning, and I suppose I could say to you and to your listeners, people need to have a look at this and respond to the consultation. You know, if people have got things to say, let's not just rubbish it. Let's not just do the executive down, but let's try and be constructive about it. And that's certainly what I'll be doing as an independent think tank in how I respond. And I'd encourage other people to look at it properly.
I don't want to convey any negativity. What I'm trying to do this morning is for those people who do want to connect with Stormont, for those people who do want to trust them, I'm trying to establish, is there stuff in here that will bond them to this political entity, to Stormont? Is there any? So, for example, they say that they will help local business cut their energy bills by investing $15 million in the Energy and Resource Efficiency Support Scheme. Is that new? They say we will also invest a further $75 million via the Invest to Save Fund into the public sector's transition to net zero. Is that new, Anne?
I don't know the detail of that. I'd have to look into it. My reading of the document yesterday, you know, just overall, was that, as I said, there was a lot of description of problems and a lot of repetition of things that have already been announced. You know, so I looked in particular at the childcare, right? In the childcare section, they talk about how childcare is unaffordable for many families. They talk about how committed they are to addressing that, helping more parents to get back into work.
They say they're investing up to $25 million this year. They say that
they've already announced that. That's already been announced. So if you're pressing for more changes to childcare and to sort of make childcare make it more available to at the kind of scale that it is in the rest of the UK, if you're pressing for that, you'll be disappointed because all that there is in there is what they've already announced.
Well, they say, they also say, we will introduce a 15% childcare subsidy for parents in receipt of tax-free childcare who have children below primary school age.
That's already been announced. That was in Paul Gibbons' childcare and early years strategy in the spring. So that's already out there and already in the budget. So, you know, that's good. That's progress since the executive came back in February. But it's not new things. It's not an additional thing that hasn't been announced already.
But is that them committing to sustaining, to be fair to them, the 15% childcare subsidy for the length of this parliament?
Yeah, but I would have thought that would have happened anyway. I mean, I wouldn't think you'd put a scheme in place like that and then take it away. You know, you don't start funding childcare and everybody changes their arrangements and, you know, starts to do more hours at work and gets their child into a certain nursery. You don't do that and then just take it away. So I'm not sure that's really anything new.
How important is an early learning and childcare strategy? Because they say they will develop one. Again, they don't say by when.
Yeah.
I would say that
that's vitally important for two reasons. One is the affordability of childcare for working parents, which has got very, very difficult, and lots of examples of parents who have stopped working because of the cost of childcare. But secondly, supporting children in their early years, particularly children from more disadvantaged backgrounds, is absolutely essential to helping address disadvantage and helping narrow the gap between children coming from different backgrounds. So the very best thing you can do to help somebody get do well at school and get on the right track is to give them really good support in the preschool years.
So let's look cup half full, finally, right? And if there is someone thinking today, okay, great, they're going to invest in young children, this early learning and childcare strategy, I want to participate in this consultation, I want to get involved, I want to say, well done, thank you. Why would the executive not say when they're going to do it? Like, what is their strategy? What's their motive behind leaving out any type of date around when they will develop a strategy to help the youngest, most deprived children in our society? Why would they not put a date in that?
I mean, on that, they have said what they're actually doing on the 15% subsidy and on the extra hours for the preschool year. So they have said that. In terms of what else they're going to do to meet their, you know, their overall priority of more affordable childcare, they don't know at the minute because they haven't got the funding in place. They haven't got the plans in place. So they haven't.
But in terms of that strategy, they say they will I'm not even talking about implementing the strategy.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about when it will be developed so that it's ready to go. Why would they not tell us when they will have that ready to read? Not implement, to read.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, committing to doing things and not saying when you're going to do them, that's not good enough, is it? I agree.
And well, thank you. 030-30-80-55-55. I don't want to be asking just negative questions this morning. I'm appealing to our political parties today. Give us the positivity. Give us the reasons why you have signed up to this. Mike Nesbitt, our health minister, explain to us why and how you're backing a document which tells us that waiting lists will not be cut under the current funding. Mike, have you no options in your head as to how money might be diverted to health? Or was this about collective responsibility and are you bound into this? Naomi Long, our Justice Minister, what message does this send to John Boucher? But much more importantly, the men and women who are currently on the streets. One line about policing? No amount of money? No commitment? No guarantee that the 4,500 officers, which Boucher says is just not doable. How did you sign up to this document, Naomi? The one line about policing, actively seeking to achieve a sufficient number of police officers. Does that mean asking the Treasury for more money and if they don't give it to you, nothing happens? We'll come to your calls in just a second. Jared's our first call today. Morning, Jared.
Morning, Stephen. I fear that you're right to be negative in your question today because it may be great for Michelle O'Neill and Emma Little-Pengelly to be objective and say, oh, things are good or could be good. The harsh reality is, I am literally going today to get a letter from my GP to go for a private MRI because the waiting list for an MRI up here would be years, probably. I think it's crazy.
So what if you didn't have the money?
Well, you wouldn't be getting it then.
But what would happen to you as an individual citizen in this country if you did not have the money for that MRI?
You wouldn't get it.
Yeah, but period. And then what?
Well,
is this a cancer scan or what is this for?
No, it's actually a back scan. But I did tell you before, I've been waiting. Well, it would be almost 2 years now on a dermatology appointment, which never came. And I told you before, I ended up freezing the thing off myself because I had previously had one. So that's the reality of our health service. And you don't get to see a GP. Magnus GP have done this over the phone for me. I mean, I didn't physically have an appointment.
Do you feel that they're at least being honest with you? That they, if the Treasury doesn't stump up, they have no thinking as to how to cut waiting lists. They're going to, I presume the best they can do is maintain them as to where they're at. Do you think that's honesty or do you think that's failure?
They're honest to an extent, but I think where there's a lot of wastage of money at the minute is, I can only talk up where we live up in Kilkeel, but there's a lot of locum doctors in getting a lot of money from in locum doctors. Now, you can't see your own GP. I don't even know who my own GP is anymore. I don't know if he's even there. So it's created absolutely mental up here, or anywhere in most places that I know.
In 2011, Department of Health was allocated 41% of the executive's budget. This has risen to 52% today. So in the same period, outcomes have declined significantly. Waiting lists have gone up by 216% between March 2014 and March 2023. In terms of children, the latest available statistics show that at 31st of March 2023, 22,875 children in Northern Ireland were known to social services as a child in need, and almost 4,000 children were in care. Services are struggling to meet this demand. So that's kids. While we're talking about kids, if you're listening to Good Morning Ulster this morning, you heard that there's not one mention in any of this 88-page document about child poverty in Northern Ireland. It's not a priority. So if and look, it's about hard choices. If they can't prioritise children in poverty, then you then look to what they are prioritising and what meat is on the bone. David next. Morning, David.
Hello, Stephen.
Good morning. What do you think, David, about the programme for government?
Well, on paper, it doesn't sound too bad, but just a couple of things here I wanted to say. I was listening to the TV this morning and the Conservatives were on slamming Labour for the winter fuel payment deduction for pensioners. But sure, they were doing the same last year when they were taking it off disabled. They were going to take it off disabled people. So one's as bad as the other. But what I really phoned in about was how we ourselves could help with some revenue-raising things. But on a voluntary basis, I think I spoke to you before about it.
Tell me what your idea is, David.
Well, I guess, and I've spoke to, it was over a year ago, and I've spoke to people since here on benefits, disability allowance, tax credits, all this, and people who's working. And I thought, do you know what? Why not have a voluntary scheme where, like, say I have a doctor's appointment, and I go in, and there's somewhere you can put a donation, say £1, £2, whatever. Say I go to A&E, when I go through that A&E door and go up to the counter, I put a donation. Say I stay in hospital, I give a donation. £2, £2.50 for a prescription. Everybody I know said would pay it. And there's 50 million prescriptions given out in Northern Ireland over a year. There's over 110, 20 million just on the £2.50 donation for a prescription.
It's an idea, David. It's you reaching out. Essentially, what you're doing is you're trying to create in your head different ways of revenue raising. That's what you're doing, right?
And you're not forcing people. I mean, you're not forcing people
Absolutely.
To do it.
But what you're doing is coming up with an idea to raise revenue. That
yeah,
is
and
more.
I haven't got brains. I'm just sitting as a clampet thinking the ideas.
Well, you're not
Why
a clampet.
Why are politicians not doing it?
There's the question. Where are...
The problem, I'll tell you why, Stephen. They are afraid of doing it and losing votes. But what they don't realise, they mustn't be going round and asking the normal human being people who are saying, I wouldn't mind doing that if it means my health's going to be better, the health service, schools are going to be better. So they're not connecting with people and asking. Where? I've actually said, see when people come round whenever the election was on, I was telling local councillors, no, please do this.
Well, look,
nobody's going to stop voting for you.
David, whether your idea is good or not, you're sitting in the House and you're trying to come up with a way to raise revenue for Northern Ireland. That is more than the entire political entities, the politicians. That
Can
is
I have
more
their 80,000?
Than the politicians have actually come up with in this programme for government document in terms of revenue raising. They've said that financial stability requires brave decisions. They haven't come up with any proposal.
I'd like you to do me a favour.
But David, in North Belfast, you've trumped them this morning. David,
well, I want you, when you have them actually on sitting talking, I want you to say anything. People on PIP, people on attendance allowance, people in pensions, I have spoke of hundreds, and I'm not joking, hundreds, okay. And there has been one person said, that wouldn't do for me. They've all said, I wouldn't mind that.
Okay, David, thank you very much. Morning to you. I think it's important to reach out to people who think that this is a positive document because we want to look across the piece. If you're listening to Gamu this morning, the chair of the British Medical Association, Alan Stout, is positive about what the executive is doing here. Good morning to you, Alan.
Good morning, Stephen.
If the top line message, Alan, is health is one of their priorities, but they won't be able to cut waiting lists unless Westminster gives them more, why are you so positive?
Yeah, I mean, we're determined to get some positivity out of it. And I suppose the overriding positivity is where we are right now. If we were speaking this time last year, we had no government. We absolutely had no programme for government. So I think it is important that we have some priorities and we have a direction. Now, I look at it slightly differently in that one of our greatest fears was that this was going to be a series of targets. And we are, you know, we've far too many targets and we miss the vast bulk of them. And so we wanted, when we were expecting the programme for government, we wanted something that looked a little bit more creative, that brought us into the future, that was bold
and
ambitious.
So where is the creativity, the boldness, the ambition in terms of health?
Yeah, so that again is I think where the next conversation needs to come. And I know that the Minister, Mike Nesbitt, is already starting those conversations. He's invited Raphael Bengoa back and he is determined to try and re-trigger that proper change. And the comment that
but
I made
terms,
earlier...
In terms, Alan, and it's important you say that, and let's hope that Mike comes on this programme, other programmes, and sets out his vision for what he can change. Absolutely, 100%. But in terms of this document, 7 months they've been up and going again.
Okay.
Can you see ambition? Can you see how Stormont is making a difference within this programme for government in terms of people's health?
Yeah, I can. And,
tell us
and I'll
where.
Tell you what, I'll tell you why, because the headline is waiting lists, and it's easy to take that as the reducing waiting lists. But when you actually look at the description underneath it, so the worst thing that could have happened were that we would have got a series of targets, which we would have missed, and we would have got a short-term bung, potentially, through Westminster with no long-term sustainable solutions involved in that. We've been there before. That doesn't work. That's not going to
change. So help me, because I'm desperate for this. So show me what is in this document that will change people's health lives.
So actually what they've put is actually consistent with a lot, and even the Bengoa report 8 years ago, believe it or not now, and it talks about proactive shifting to proactive care, about caring for our population, particularly our most vulnerable, about prevention, a prevention strategy, as opposed to just reacting all the time. It doesn't give a date in it. But again, the difficulty is that proper change becomes harder to measure. But that is about those fundamental decisions. That's about how we actually deliver our health service. I'll give you a very simple example, which as prior change of the GP committee is kind of right up my street. Northern Ireland, our health service invests 5.4% of our health budget in general practice. That is the lowest that we can find anywhere in the world, proportionally of the total health spend. And that is why one of your previous callers was saying about couldn't access his GP. It's the most fundamental, basic part of delivering a health service. And until we change that, until we get ahead of the problems that we have, we're going to continue getting the same thing over and over and over again, which is where people end up on waiting lists, where people end up in EDs, they can't get discharged from hospital and so on. And we have to reverse that entire model.
There's a short paragraph within this document where again, I nearly fell off my seat in terms of what's coming ahead, and therefore how agile, how smart we need our politicians to be. And it's about demography. Demography, or how do you say that word? I have no idea how to even say it.
Demography. Yeah,
demography, there we go.
And the ageing population.
And still be raging with me, but it's more important than that. Here we go. By 2043, it is anticipated that the proportion of our population over the age of 85 will have more than doubled.
Yeah.
This will result in further pressures on social care and a dramatically reduced working age population. The pressures of regional imbalance are also likely to increase. So, over the age of 85, we'll have more than doubled by 2043. What are we going to do about it?
Yeah, so again, the key with that is not a new figure. We have known about that for years and years.
So we need our political politicians to come up with ideas.
We do. And you mentioned earlier the spend, the proportion of the total Northern Ireland budget that's spent on health. Now, again, if we go back to Bengoa, the prediction within Bengoa was if we don't change our model, that we will need 80% or more of the block grant to be spent on our health service alone. That's where we're going. It's not about standing still. It's not about maintaining it at 47%. We have got to prevent it getting to 80% because we absolutely cannot afford to spend that amount of money on our health service. And that's why we need to be ahead of it. That's why we need to have that
proactive. But would it be too much? Would it be too much, Alan, for the public to have expected, even with that which we've just talked about, a document? Like, how many civil servants, how many advisors are there in Stormont? Well, is there a document that has been generated in the last 7 months quoting one idea of what we do with what we've just talked about? I'll tell you another thing I noticed in this document. You talked about GP services. Again, front-facing, so important to the public. I could do 7 shows a week about people not being able to get through to their doctor and the pressures on doctors. You're the chair of the BMA. You know what it's like. There is not one mention of GP services in this whole document. Nada. Nothing.
Yeah. I should be more annoyed about that than you are, but I'm not convinced that this particular document is where that should go. I think that is some of the detail. This is about direction. This is about big picture. This is about public consultation. So I'm relatively relaxed about that part of it at the moment, so long as we get the direction right. And that's why I have a bit of positivity about it, because I'm actually encouraged that the language that is being used and the discussion or the descriptions that are being used are consistent with where we know we need to go. But I absolutely fundamentally agree. I mean, there's 99% of the detail is missing. But I think if you put all of that detail into this document, you'd completely lose people. The public, and lose all of us.
How come Scotland, in their programme for government document, have been able, in terms of health? And by the way, there are many other areas I want to talk about this morning. But how come they've been able to commit to guarantee some of the services that that they will improve with hard numbers against them?
Yeah, I mean, two things on that. One is Scotland's in a vastly different position. They've got a foundation. They've had government for years. They've had devolution, and they've got a different kind of
funding.
We've
got devolution.
We do, but we know the on-off nature of it, and we know the impact that those past number of years have had on us. But again, be careful when I speak to our counterparts, to my counterparts in Scotland. These aren't guarantees. These are targets that they have set, and Scotland will miss targets like we miss targets. And I think,
and then they'll be held to account for them.
They will, but I think we would have been doing a disservice to the public if we just simply put in another range of targets. Only last week we were reporting on the latest waiting list targets, you know, and people are just fed up, and they're actually now immune to target after target being missed and missed and missed. And we've got to be cleverer than that, and we can't just have this binary transactional discussion on it. It's got to be a proper, legitimate, sustainable change.
Alan, thank you very much. Deborah next. Morning, Deborah.
Good morning, Stephen. It's just nice to talk to you again. I'm an old colleague of yours, and I have dined with you, and we have had a conversation on your TV programme.
Great.
But you probably do not remember me. But, Stephen, I am here this morning, and I have tried several times this past number of weeks to get talking to you to put my view forward and been unsuccessful.
Well, so here you are, Deborah. Shoot.
Very thankful that I am getting the opportunity this morning. Now, my idea, Stephen, is that the law needs to be changed, not only here in Northern Ireland, but throughout the United Kingdom, on the sickness benefit rule. I'm sure you're not aware, Stephen, that people in the private sector, when they go off sick, they do not get paid. All they get is the statutory sick pay, which the government pays, which is, what, about £80 a week or something like that. Their employer does not make their pay up. So therefore, if you worked in a hotel or something like that in hospitality or several other self-employed, etc., when you are off, maybe with the flu for a fortnight, all you get is your statutory sick pay. But on the other hand, if you work in the public sector, and that means working for the BBC, I would say, Stephen, for the police, for the prison service, all those jobs up in Stormont, and our leaders in Stormont, our doctors, our nurses, and everyone else that is in the public sector, when they are off sick, they get their pay made up. So therefore, the statutory sick pay is taken out of their monthly pay or weekly pay, and their employer pays them the rest.
So you're proposing scrapping it. So if you're genuinely sick, do you think people shouldn't be able to pay their mortgage? Or shouldn't be able to feed their kids?
Stephen. I'm not saying that, Stephen. I'm saying that there's an awful lot of abuse in this. That I have worked in the public sector in different situations myself, and my husband worked also in the public sector, especially the Mays Prison. And I can say, Stephen, that there is a big, big number of people that think along the lines, oh,
okay.
I haven't had my couple of days sicky this month.
Deborah, thank you. Morning to you. Thank you for calling us. Hayley next in Antrim. Morning, Hayley.
This is going to sound a wee bit rancy, but just bear with me. David from North Belfast, he has it sorted. I love his ideas. Prescription charges. The governor or the assembly are not making hard choices, and they've been chasing their tails basically for the last, what, from 2010. It's not fair to...
Well, they say, the executives say, quote, we know that fiscal and service sustainability will require brave decisions, collaborative working, and a relentless focus on innovation and efficiency in service delivery. Have you heard any innovation within this document?
No, but what I will say is Scotland has had a consistent government for 25 years. And you're looking here where they have been out of this term 2 years. So, I mean, there's no consistency. They need to sort themselves out. They need to be brave. They need to be innovative. And it isn't just the rich that are having to go to private healthcare. We had to take a loan earlier this year in order for my husband to get a hernia repair. But we're paying that back now. But we're not rich. And it's just, I mean, your autism assessment is 5 years. For a child to get diagnosed or assessed for autism, it's 5 years. They need to pull their socks up, really, and do something.
Well, they talk about young people with special educational needs within this programme for government, this draft that is a draft proposal. The uh-huh. reason we're discussing it today, we're trying to encourage all of you to be part of that consultation. They say that they will work to transform the education system to provide high quality, efficient and sustainable services for children. They just don't tell you when they'll do it by.
Well, you see, the problem with that is they changed in 2016. Children with moderate learning difficulties would have previously gone to special schools, and they were moved into mainstream education. That's been a big shift in education, and there has been a lot more support having to be given, because teachers are not automatically taught special needs teaching. So that, I mean, it's just they need to look at the bigger picture, and they need to be brave.
Well, they say they say they're being brave. They say we will set out plans to enhance in school support.
Well, I can set out plans from here to the next Sunday, and doesn't mean I'm going to do them or I'm going to have any.
Where are the plans? Is 7 months not enough? Are there no advisor has come up with even a paragraph as to what those plans might look like?
It's more than 7 months.
They say we will invest in our educational workforce. To what extent?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you have to invest in your workforce. We need
range,
to keep teachers.
They say a range of, under the title, Right Time. A range of early intervention programs will be developed involving education and health professionals, which will ensure timely access to child centre effective intervention. Now, these are for some of our most vulnerable children in Northern Ireland.
It all sounds lovely, doesn't it?
Any
it
idea what the programme is? Anything done within the last 7 months since Stormont has been up and going? Anything developed by any of these advisors that can be put in front of families with children with special needs?
But
nothing.
That's the thing too, Stephen. There's a big gap. You know, health and education do not work well together. From experience, they do not work well together.
Okay.
And they need to bridge that
Hayley,
gap
thank
as well.
You. Brian, next morning, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen. On the budget, no mention of raising money. One of your callers hit it in the nail. I've said this on your programme many a time. I'm quite willing to pay for prescriptions. Pound, £2, whatever the case may be.
It's a drop in the ocean, but bring in about 20-odd million quid.
Well, Stephen...
But it's an idea how to raise revenue document is absence of any ideas as to how to raise revenue other than going over to Westminster and saying, please give us more money.
Well, we're not going to get it. So we have to raise money. And if we believe in what the government is saying, there's no money, which I take with a pinch of salt anyway at the end of the day. As a pensioner, I'm quite prepared to pay, give a contribution from my pension.
Well, maybe you should feed that into the consultation. Stormont is urging you to consult. It'll be for an 8-week period, this consultation, open and up and running. 0330 80 55 55 is the number this morning as we approach the 10 o'clock news from the BBC. Morning, everyone. Thank you for being with us today. My goodness, there are so many calls wanting to talk about your government. That's good. And be it praise for them. I know that Emma Little Pengelly and Michelle O'Neill are going off to meet the Chancellor on Thursday. What day is that? That's in 2 days' time. So, look, praise where it's due. You might think to yourself, good, thank you for going over there. Thank you for fighting for Northern Ireland. Maybe it's strategically good that the executive is saying that they can't do so many things without more money. Maybe they're trying to, from Westminster, maybe they're trying to create that leverage. Someone has written into the programme today, pulling me up and saying that Stormont has tax raising powers. Just to be clear what I was talking about, for example, with the domestic rates in Northern Ireland, Stormont has a number of levers that could be pulled. For example, they could lift the cap that there currently is on the rateable value of a house. They have decided not to do that. There was speculation that they could have put rates up, for example, by 15%. They decided not to do that, and they went up by 4-odd%. In terms of water charges, you could describe that as a tax. These are the type of things I was meaning. Sinn Féin were straight out. Other political parties were straight out, ruling out water charges. Now, that is to protect people from those charges. That might be good. But that's the type of things that I'm talking about when I was talking about their tax raising powers. And I'm happy to make that clear to you this morning. Alex Kane, former Director of Communications with the Ulster Unionist Party, with us today. Good morning to you, Alex.
Good morning, Stephen.
Some people this morning, Alex, are saying, look, it's not ideal, but in this mandatory coalition, it's at least good that they could agree on this broad list of priorities. And maybe we're expecting too much to ask them to have actual ideas as to how to implement them. Is that depressing, or is that cup half full? It's a good thing.
I think in Northern Ireland, particularly with the budgeting and the executive, Stephen, it's always a cup half full thing. But it is worth bearing in mind, and has been mentioned a number of times in your programme over the past few weeks, that while this, you know, we're finally got to a draft programme for government, you know, we haven't had one. I think Newton Emerson said you a few days ago, we haven't actually had a full programme for government which has been accepted, agreed and implemented since 2011. So you have to bear in mind, Stephen, that this, we're talking about a decade later, the first time we've had a proper programme for government. And I'm not going to knock them. The fact that they managed to get so much of paper is a good thing in one way. But, you know, there's so many things. The very fact that they haven't been properly costed, by their own admission, they haven't been costed. The priorities in themselves have not, in fact, been prioritised. They put down a list of priorities they will work to, but they haven't prioritised their priorities because they can't do that until they talk to the Treasury. And there's one other thing, Steve, which I don't think has been mentioned by anyone in your programme this morning. And this, we're not simply talking about a draft programme for government. We're talking about a draft programme for government out for public consultation. That process lasts 2 months. At the end of that process, I don't know. It could be hundreds of people and organisations, individuals, experts, cranks, right? It could be thousands. We don't know. But we do know that it'll be then another few weeks while the departments work their way through all of this, decide what's going to go. Then they'll have to chat about it again. And this is a crucial thing, Stephen. Go to page 84. Because as you know, I'm obsessed about the trifles. I'm obsessed about the small things and documents. You go to page 84. It says, after consultation is complete and the final programme for government is put in place, the budget process will prioritise commitments made in the programme for government. So the public consultation is going to have an impact, not necessarily what's happened in the Assembly. The public consultation then go on and says, this will help departments plan ahead and get ready to deliver our joint priorities, but the executive will still need to work together to develop and agree detailed policies before delivery begins. So I fear, Stephen, and I genuinely fear this, that come the beginning of next year, you will have me and Anne and others on this programme going, what's happened? I thought they'd agreed all of this, and now we've been told they haven't actually agreed how they're going to deliver.
But what have they agreed? You take a broad term. You take policing. So what have they agreed over in terms of policing, Alex? In this programme for government, what have they agreed?
Nothing. Nothing has been agreed specifically on anything, Stephen. On health, nothing has been agreed. If they've been blunt on health, saying that while waiting, I think it's in their nine, you know, cut health waiting times, but then saying a few sentences later, we don't have the funding to do it. And that's been, I don't even know when, all they've done at the end of the document, as you can see there, is they put a list of how the present budget proposal has been broken down with a huge, huge whack of it going to health and then about 2 billion to education and the rest cut down. I'm telling you, Stephen, I'm not an economist, but there is nowhere close to the amount of money they need. And I think they need to be more blunt. And I know they're going, you know, that Emma and Michelle are going to see the Treasury. And what are they going to say to the Treasury? Because the Treasury is going to ask them two things, Stephen. On the basis that 9 million pensioners are about to lose their, you know, the winter fuel, and there'll be other cuts elsewhere, and the national pension is going up much lower than people thought it was going to be. They're going to say to them, OK, in what way are you going to pay your way? And the second thing they're going to ask them, because they will have this document, they'll be looking for it right now, they'll be saying, have you actually costed any single worth of these? Have you actually sat down and said, this will take 1.4 billion, give it a couple
of percent? It's not in the programme for government. They're not telling us how much they need.
That's the whole point. A programme for government which doesn't have that is not a programme for government. It is a wish list. And the stuff in there, no harm to them, Stephen. We all agree with that. It's apple pie, mama's apple pie and milk. There's nothing in there you could disagree with. But until you get to the point, and the big things, what I said, that's why that page 84 is so important, Stephen. That even their list of priorities and this talk of our plan and our mission and so on, they haven't, in fact,
prioritised the priorities. So we don't know, will the health waiting list be number one on the priority? Will it be children with SEND number one? We don't know any of that, Steve. And by the time the public consultation, I mean, get somebody on. I'd love you to hear somebody, one of the ministers or first deputy, any of them actually, or the finance minister, actually say, if you get 10,000, 15,000 answers to your public consultation, and the vast majority of those public consultations say, this is wrong, that shouldn't be done, you need to prioritise it, what are they going to do? Are they going to say, actually, we've now come up with another programme for government. And how do you then vote this? Are the parties committed? Are the four executive parties in the MLAs already committed on paper? Because if that's the case, Stephen, it doesn't matter what the public consultation comes up with, because it's going to be voted through. None of that has been discussed. And I don't want to be negative in this, Stephen, because I want devolution to work. I want good government. But I'm simply just putting through, 88 pages, basically about 75 of them, and it's a big print and so on. There's an awful lot of stuff there, Stephen. To put it bluntly, is pure waffle.
I read the paragraph earlier, I'll find it again, where they talk about needing to make brave decisions. So I thought to myself last night, okay, well, here we go. They don't say what any of the brave decisions, not only do they not specifically say, here's some of the brave decisions that we're proposing. So you've had Starmer, whether it's brave, whether it's reckless, at least he has said winter fuel payments, it's gone. He has said it. You've got the Scottish government. They have said public sector freeze on job recruitment. They've said they're going to save 500 million quid of costs. So when I saw this brave decisions, I thought, right, next paragraph, here are some of the brave decisions that we intend to propose for consultation. There is nothing. Not a word, not a jot. And I kept on reading it. And then I kept going through page after page. I was nearly going to ring John Campbell in the middle of the night and say to him, am I missing anything here? Have they actually, when they're describing themselves as being able to be brave, have they actually put one syllable of what it might be? Nothing. Now, some people might ask, do they think the public are stupid, introducing the word brave and then not telling them what they might do?
Stephen, what you get in cases like this, it's brave. Like they will say, we need to make brave decisions. We may need to make difficult decisions. We may need to make decisions which people will find uncomfortable and so on. They haven't reached any of those decisions at this point, Stephen. And that's why they go back to page 84 again, because it's only after this consultation that the executive will still need to work together to develop and agree detailed policies before delivery begins. Because my reading of this, Stephen, is that they haven't agreed. There is nothing that you could nail down and say, that you could pick out and say, phone every single member of every single minister and say, is this one of the brave decisions you've agreed on? You're just waiting for a confirmation. Not one of them would, Stephen, because they can't, because they haven't made those decisions.
I found it. 3 o'clock in the morning, I saw this. Financial sustainability will require brave decisions and collaborative working, as well as innovation and efficiency in delivery of services. We are committed to working in partnership to make that happen. Well, Michelle, Emma, Mike Nesbitt and Naomi Long, you're so committed that in the last 7 months you haven't been able to tell us what these brave decisions are. You then publish a document for the public to feed back to you on, and there is no example of what you might do.
Stephen, I'm coming back to it again. It's because they haven't agreed any of this yet. And I don't know whether the public consultation aspect, and I know we have public consultations, it happens across all the governments and so on, but not usually. You wouldn't get Keir Starmer, or the previous Conservative Prime Minister going, here's our programme, here's the King's speech or the Queen's speech at the previous time, but before we do anything on it, we're going to send it out for 3 months across the country so that you can all have your input. It doesn't work like that, Stephen. An executive in this nature has to say, this is what we believe is the right thing to do, and this is what we propose to do, and we've no. But my reading of this, and somebody can phone in and tell me if I'm wrong on this, my reading of this is that they are not in a position to make any decisions yet and won't be until probably sometime December. But there's one other thing, so just let me say this because I think it's important given what's happened in Northern Ireland since the last programme for government. I would like somewhere in this programme for government, if we're going to take it seriously, and that's for the cynics for me, it's the people who are desperate, Stephen, who are desperate to get the hospital away, who are desperate to get their kid to school, who are desperate for all those things, that they've been waiting for years. What we need, Stephen, at the heart of any programme for government is the absolute certainty of stability. We hear there, they say, oh, we'll work together, we're going to collaborate together, we're going to, you know, come up with something. There's not one paragraph, not even a, you know, a sentence which says, we give a collective commitment, singly as individual ministers, collectively as the executive government of Northern Ireland, we give you a commitment that there are no circumstances under which this executive will be brought down, because it happened in 2015, it happened in 2016, 2017, it happened in 22 when they brought the whole thing down again. I mean, if we get to the point in, say, a year's time when over, and they've no mention of the Windsor Framework or anything in this document either, if we get to a point where they're falling out over
something like that again,
all brought down, it doesn't matter what the programme for government will say, Steve, because it'll be in the bin by that stage.
Tell me this finally. Has the wider executive, while some of them are publicly supporting John Boucher, given the fact that there's one line in this about policing numbers, it doesn't talk about money, it doesn't talk about amounts of money, has Boucher been put back in his box?
I don't think so at this point. And also, I have to be careful with this. John Boucher does not strike me as a man who will be put back into any sort of box, put back easily into any sort of box, Stephen. So I think there may be some reluctance for the executive ministers to say anything, but I think that is an argument which is still, albeit quietly at the minute, it's still ongoing.
Okay. Alex Kane, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. Emma Little-Pengelly at Stormont last night accused Enda McClafferty, our political editor, of being negative, and also had a pop at the official opposition, the SDLP. They went on the attack in the Assembly chamber. Later during ministerial questions, Emma Little-Pengelly, well, her patience was wearing thin.
It just feels a little bit like Groundhog Day, only without any of the fun or entertainment in it, but just relentless negativity. Look, you can have opposition for opposition's sake, or you can have opposition which is constructive. And I have looked to the document that he has produced, and there is significantly more detail in the document that we have produced, indubitably so. And therefore, we are asking people's views on our 9 key priorities.
The Justice Minister, Naomi Long, was asked if she supported the Chief Constable's request for further funding for the PSNI. Here's what Naomi said.
At the end of the day, what it is about is working with the Chief Constable through the structures that we have. The reality is, in the devolved institutions, money that comes to Northern Ireland is not hypothecated. It is actually for this Assembly, on the basis of recommendations brought by the Executive, to vote through a budget and decide how we spend our money locally. And so that is the reality of the situation, that even were the Chief Constable to be successful in lobbying in Westminster, that money will come to the Department of Finance, and it will be for us around the Executive table and in this room to decide where that money ends up. So the important thing is that I work closely, as I have been, with the Chief Constable to build the strongest possible case at the Executive table so that funding that does come to Northern Ireland actually makes it into the Department of Justice's budget, because to date that has not been the case.
Naomi, you say you've been working closely with the Chief Constable. You endorsed and supported a letter which rebuked the Chief Constable, and that was sent to up to 30 different people. Glyn Roberts, Retail Northern Ireland Chief Executive, with us today. Glyn, what's your feeling about the possibilities? Let's talk positively about the possibilities that this Programme for Government document presents.
Well, I think first and foremost, its publication is a positive. Is it a perfect document? Certainly it isn't. And in many respects, you know, it tells us what the promised land is, but doesn't tell us how to get there, or indeed how much that journey will cost to get us there. But I think that in many respects, it's not just a change of policy that we need. It's actually a change in how the executive does policy. So we want to see this programme for government not just as a deal between four political parties, but a co-design effort between broader civic society, because in the business community and trade unions and the voluntary sector, we have lots of ideas about how we can turn around this economy, invest in our health service, and get that sort of step change we need in our education system.
So have you presented those ideas to the executive and they just haven't included them in this document, or what?
Well, we're not short of ideas. We produced our own draft programme for government back in 2022. We're going to update that and submit that. So, you know, we're putting ideas, we're putting evidence-based solutions to the executive all the time. And one of the things that we also need to sort of factor in is that this needs to be about delivery. This can't be some academic exercise or a wish list. This has to deliver for real working people who are on waiting lists, who can't get their special needs child into the school of their choice. We need to really focus and drill down how we grow our economy, create more and better jobs, and regenerate our high streets. So I think that this is.
And is it in there for you?
Well, there's not everything that's in there. For instance, the High Street Task Force, which I was one of the chairs of, its report isn't in. It was designed to be an annex of the programme for government. That's something we're going to be asked. There's a lot of things we want to see. For instance, we pay the most expensive business rate in the UK. That's holding back our economy. It's holding back growth. We also want to see reforms to the planning system. And, of course, something that you touched upon there is funding for the police, particularly funding for neighbourhood police. You know, our members are facing an epidemic of shoplifting and assault on their staff. So we need a properly funded police service that's going to play its part in tackling that problem.
So are you welcoming this document, or are you criticising it?
Well, I think it's a start. I think the problem is any other coalition government, the first thing they do is design a programme for government. Then they decide to the ministries who gets what ministries. We do it the other way around. So straight away, that creates difficulties around policy. It creates problems for a joined-up approach. And in your programme yesterday, you had parties in the same executive attacking each other. So any other coalition government, that doesn't happen to the same degree. So what we need to get is an executive that is embracing change, that is working together, and it is really delivery-focused. And the business community, we're not short, as I said, of ideas. There's lots of things we want to see in this programme of government. And do you know what? We'll be putting forward that. You also have major consultations in terms of the Good Jobs Bill, the Department of Economy. The Economy Department also launched a three-year plan as well. So they're putting lots of ideas out there. I think it's important that civic society, yes, we criticise where we need to, but we need to be solution-based. We need to put ideas to them, because our members are just as much a partner in all this. And if we want to grow our economy, regenerate our high streets, then Okay. Working with the retail sector is so important.
Glyn Roberts, Retail NI Chief Executive, thank you. John Burrows was a former senior police officer joining us this morning. So to justice, John, and the promises within this programme for government draft, it is a draft document. Do you see much response to John Boucher, who has said that police numbers are dangerously low, that they are unsustainable, and police officers may take their own lives. More police officers may take their own lives, given the pressure they're under.
Yeah, morning, Stephen. Look, some of the things in justice are, you know, it's good to see them expressed as a priority. For example, violence against women and girls is a standalone priority. But one of the fatal undermining factors in this is that the reality is that the police service of Northern Ireland, with 4,500 operationally deployable police officers, is not able to do all of the things that this strategy asks it to do. And let me put it like this. When you have a police service so underfunded like the PSNI, it becomes a reactive police service, right? So it'll answer 999 calls, it'll respond. It'll investigate murders reactively after they've happened and other serious crimes. It will tackle terrorism because it has to, or step up to rioting when it happens. But it won't do all the things that this strategy asks for it to do, like getting upstream of crime, speeding up the justice system, getting into schools and changing the minds of dealing with the attitudes of young people in terms of violence against
women and
girls. It
does talk about speeding up the justice system, doesn't it?
It does, but when you've less officers, it talks about, you know, in terms of violence against women and girls, for example, it talks about changing the attitudes at an early stage around young people about how to build healthy relationships. That's all stuff that police officers are in schools and have been doing, but that's going to be cut back. So a lot of your preventative work in policing is almost like your luxury. Now, it's not a luxury because it's vital, but it's the stuff that goes first. And unfortunately, without a funded police service, you're not going to do all the prevention and all the engagement and all the upstream work that's needed in this strategy.
So what does the future feel like here if this programme for government is played out? Like, do we know where we will be with policing? As far as you're being told yes or no within this programme for government?
No, and there's a vague reference to resourcing, which says that, you know, the commitment to under New Deal,
New
agreement. Yeah. But the reality is, on the very issue of resourcing, there's actually a debate at the minute about how they're going about, you know, approaching the chief constable, and that's turned into a bit of a bun fight, unfortunately. So, you know, throughout this, there are problems. Look, violence against women and girls is terrible. Northern Ireland, it is an epidemic. We're the second highest in Europe, I think the latest figures are, in terms of femicide. But, you know, unless you've got the police service, you're not going to be able to give the victims the service they need. Victims of domestic violence, sexual abuse, they drop out of the criminal justice system every time there's a delay. And we've got one of the longest criminal justice delays in the UK. And again, the strategy is very general. It doesn't give bullet points. What are we going to do? How are we going to speed up the criminal justice system? How are we going to change the approach to sentencing so there's more confidence in victims? You know, how are we going to...
Well, they say they've got brave and innovative ideas, which, of course, they don't spell out.
Well, they don't spell out. And then how can you consult on them? So, you know, what we need is the executive to lead. Some of this stuff isn't rocket science. What we need is sufficient police officers to do excellent investigations, but also get proactive and upstream.
Well, Boucher said, Chief Constable Boucher said, he told the policing board he would be disappointed if policing was not front and centre of the programme for government. He got one line back.
Well, you get one line back, and then there's almost a check being written that he can't cash, because all of the talk about prevention that's in this, all of the talk about improving confidence of victims and speeding up the criminal justice system, he can't do any of that in terms of playing his side of the bargain, because he doesn't have the numbers. What he's going to be doing is doing the emergency response, making sure that if there's a serious crime, the PSNI investigate it. You've heard him say there'd be neighbourhood policing in name only. You know, we're closing police stations. That's the reality. And none of this is going to happen. And, you know, behind the sort of the woolly language and the nice ideals and sentiments, A, there's little detail about how they're going to do it. But B, they don't have the wherewithal to do it because you don't have a police service that's funded. You know, and even tackling paramilitarism. You know, you have a line in, yes, we're going to tackle paramilitarism, blah, blah, blah. But within the executive, then we have people in our government who use ambivalent language towards paramilitarism. You know, old boys clubs asking paramilitaries to use their good influence. So, you know, there's a lot to sort through here. But, you know, I'm afraid to say that you will not get a Rolls-Royce policing service. You'll get a kind of serviceable five-year-old car with 70,000 miles on it. And that's not what's going to deliver the sort of things that they want. You're going to have a reactive police service that just does enough to keep its officers at work, to keep itself well and do the bare minimum.
Well, but they do say, don't they, that they are going, it's under the heading Safer Communities, they're going to actively seek to achieve a sufficient number of police officers in line with NDNA commitments. Now, they know that could mean anything. That's left open, so vague, that, you know, are they asking for money from Westminster, and if they don't get it, do the police numbers remain low? We just don't know. It's not spelt out.
It's not spelled out, so how do you hold them to account for it? How do you consult on that? You know, some of this that they're asking the public to consult on is actually stuff we just want the executive to lead on. You know, go with a and they're not even singing off the same hymn sheet. There's a debate in the Assembly yesterday about how the reaction to John Boucher's approach to number 10. You know, so, you know, it's not just vague, but the Assembly isn't all singing off the same hymn sheet in terms of how we do this.
John, thank you very much. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. The Nolan Show will be continuing to give you a voice as part of this consultation. See you tomorrow. Thank you very much indeed. Bye-bye.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet @StephenNolan.